So, tonight we take up Patanjali and the Yoga Sutras. We have been, for the last couple of weeks, working again with the Vedanta tradition, an extension of the Vedic. Tonight, when we come to look at the Yoga Sutras, we again are not working truly with the Vedantic materials. There are problems and problems galore with the study of Patanjali's Yoga Sutras. So let's go through it a little at a time. The idea of a philosophy of yoga is something that we have part of the long Indian philosophic tradition, where there are six primary schools. One of them is the Sankhya Yoga school, specifically called so. You'll remember the Sankhya that we talked about earlier. There was a sage, Kapila, who had this primary insight into the divisibility of the witness consciousness, the Purusha, from the active phenomena of nature. Prakriti could be analyzed step by step, enumerated since the term Sankhya. And one could, through philosophic reflection, gain liberation from connection to this nature, which led one to suffer, led one to the mixing of consciousness with phenomena that was not advantageous to the consciousness. Yoga adds the concept of Ishvara. So say the old commentators. Otherwise, the yoga philosophy is exactly the same as Sankhya. The Yoga Sutras, which seem to us to be the main body of words by which the yoga philosophy is communicated, is attributed to Patanjali. We will dispense with ideologies and mythologies in looking at this tonight. There are a number of people who carry the name Patanjali in ancient India. One of them is a grammarian, probably a couple of centuries BCE. Another who is associated with the Yoga Sutras probably comes 200 or 300 years later. If we had to assign a date to the Yoga Sutras, probably around 100 CE is as close as we can get to being firm. Ancient India knew other teachings of yoga. In the Mahabharata, in the sixth book, and again in the 12th book, there are long descriptions of what yoga is about. You're very familiar with one. The Bhagavad Gita occurs there. And while Sankhya and yoga make an appearance in that work, it is clearly not the Yoga Sutras that we have received, which are being looked at, which are being referred to. The Yoga Sutras come some centuries later. When we read them, we find the Yoga Sutras to speak of an eightfold path. But eightfold paths there were aplenty. In the Mahabharata, there was an eightfold path. The Buddhists talked about the Noble Eightfold Path, which Buddha pronounced throughout the northern part of India. a primary motive is teaching. So perhaps some of this, washing back to us from what we would eventually call the Hindu culture, could be a response to what was already being fomented and distributed, disseminated by the Buddhist teachers. When we look at the actual sutras, they're very dense. They're aphoristic. In fact, they're something like 195 verses. In all those verses, there are four verbs. Does this sound like the work of a grammarian who has written a Mahabhasha, a great commentary on Panini's grammar? No. A grammarian would never leave us in doubt about what he means. But when we look at the Yoga Sutras, they are very dense, very difficult to penetrate. They're written in a very abstruse style. There are four chapters. The first three chapters are the most spare in their language. And the Sanskrit looks like the Buddhist hybrid Sanskrit, which was much in vogue at that period. The last chapter, which is strongly adjectival, which has lots of descriptors, is from a much later kind of Sanskrit and has no relation stylistically with what we see in the first three chapters. And so scholars are on solid ground, I think, in trying to see something going on there with the tradition of the Yoga Sutras that allowed a later teaching to be incorporated into it. And to cut to the chase, it looks like the Yoga Sutras in the first three chapters were a carryover of teachings which might already have been present in Buddhism or which are an echo of Buddhist practice. The fourth chapter is strongly Hinduistic and could have been written as much as 600 or 700 years later. The Buddhists, you might know this from your own studies, at that period, at their full strength, were very combative. And if a teaching arose that contradicted or took aim at any of their principles, they were very strongly voiced in combating it. They are curiously silent about the Yoga Sutras. And at least a couple of scholars these days think that is likely because they agreed with it, because it originally came from them and had been borrowed into this field. So this material that we're looking at here, because it is Sankhya and because it may have Buddhistic origins, is not Vedic and is probably not Hindu in origin. Later, the compiler Vyasa gets his hands on it and in a sense wrenches it away from the Buddhists, applies his theistic interpretations to what was already there in the first three chapters by adding the fourth. And let us also note that in almost none of the manuscripts do you find these 195 verses standing alone, extant by themselves. They're always blended in, almost always blended in, with about 1,100 verses from Vyasa, the compiler who we think, some of us think anyway, added this fourth chapter. So, more than that, we could say the primary goal of the Yoga Sutras is to stop the perturbations of the mind so that it can fix itself upon what is eternal in its own consciousness behind the mind, and thereby quit connection to nature. So it is strongly renunciant in its goal. It means to divide the Purusha from Prakriti absolutely. So there are a number of principles which we can go through. And if we wanted to look at this sort of from the top down, there is a principle called Ishvara, which is prominently mentioned in the Yoga Sutras. Ishvara is a word which means Lord. It does not quite have the theistic connotation that it will a few hundred years later, but the word occurs here. The idea is that there is a supreme Purusha, not the creator of the world, but who has never been involved in noticing the world, but has always maintained his absolute status away from it, has never fallen victim to watching the world and becoming attached to it. Singular in that regard. He's the only Purusha who has done that. And he is eternally ensconced in this self-awareness. Now, there are limitless numbers of other Purushas, of which we can presume that we are numbered. And these have the capacity for the same freedom that Ishvara has. He is Lord of himself by never having been, in a sense, seduced by nature. So if these Purushas, which we are at core, decide to do it, we can abstract ourselves from nature. But who is this nature? Well, sitting right next door to the Purusha is another eternal entity, Prakriti. Prakriti also is eternal. And it's interesting that Patanjali refers to Prakriti in the singular. There may be a sutra where it's plural, but usually, almost always, it's singular. When Purusha comes to regard Prakriti, actually looks and sees this, then a kind of mind wave gets created. Right next door to the Purusha, in other words, is the mind stuff, the chitta. And what composes this mind stuff? Well, the interaction of Purusha with Prakriti, as we've learned from the Sankhya philosophy, stimulates Prakriti into movement. The three gunas arise and begin their motionful dance. The Purusha, or many Purushas, watching this become entranced in the dance, and all of phenomena come into being. All phenomena, according to the Yoga Sutras, are real. They are genuine. They exist. This is strongly different, isn't it, from the Vedantic solution, the Advaita solution of Shankara, which says that none of this is really moving. To Sankhya and Yoga, yes, the principle of Prakriti in movement is real. The forms that come into existence are real. It is the Purusha's sustained noticing, taking awareness of these, that gives them their reality. But the forms are themselves archetypal and exist always. It is only the phenomenal movement of them that gets dissolved with the withdrawal of the Purusha consciousness, should that occur. So what the goal of the seeker is in looking for his true self is to recognize that by watching Prakriti, a number of things come into being. First, the mind has an object, a subtle object to look at. That throws a kind of shadow existence into subtle senses. Those subtle senses densify and become concrete. And so a whole chain of being has come, stretching from gross matter all the way up to subtle matter, into the senses, gross and subtle, and then into the mind, which gathers all this together, composes a kind of order, presents it to the ego self, who says, I am, and look at what I'm seeing. And then that is sustained by the buddhi, the insight, which is next door to the purusha. So if we can remove our attention from the gross objects through the gross senses back to the sense of self, we dissolve mind, object, sensation, and arrive back at the root intelligence. Sensation does not exist until consciousness says so. So suffering does not exist until consciousness says so. But as soon as Purusha pushes out and becomes buddhi, and all the rest of it leading down to grossest nature, he's caught. So he's got to unchain himself and pull all the way back up and finally renounce even the subtlest, vastest intelligence, because that's not really the intelligence. Even buddhi draws its light from the purusha who watches. It seems to be intelligent, but it's by reflection of the buddhi's light in it that it seems intelligent. So if you withdraw all the way from that, you reside in that purusha consciousness, and you abstract yourself from this nature. So again, it's a path of renunciation. You can see analog after analog with Buddhism here. You can see it allying itself with the later philosophy of Shankara. This is a world-renouncing spirituality. Not like the affirmative spirituality that we met in the Rig Veda and that we saw most handsomely in the Upanishads. But it has an effective method by which you dissolve connection to the world. It lays it out in these four padas. The first is samadhi pada, which describes and defines a number of different elements in its philosophy. And then in the second pada, the sadhana pada, it tells you what you have to do to get there. Some of that teaching spills over into the third pada, which is the vibhuti pada. And therein are described what happens in the nature when one begins to become realized, when one begins to become enlightened. In the fourth pada, there, remember, this is the chapter that comes from another age and from other sources. There's a recapitulation of what's been said in the first three, and then adds a little bit of emotional power to carry you towards the completion of this absolute cessation from nature, so that you can live in this Kaivalya state, absoluteness, distinction from all. what probably people remember most about the Yoga Sutras is its second sutra, here we are, Yogas Chitta Vritti Nirodha, which means yoga is the restriction of the fluctuations of consciousness. And the second pada, that's the second. The third would be, then the seer abides in the essence. In other words, if you stop the mind from going out, if you get a strong grasp on it, can bring it to point, then all this ceases. The Yoga Sutras, of course, are also famous for their Eightfold Path. We referenced that earlier. So those are the yamas, the restraints, the niyamas, the injunctions, and then sitting in an asana, learning how to breathe with pranayama, learning how to withdraw the senses from the external objects, pratyahara, learning then, once you're inside your own consciousness, how to concentrate it, dharana, how to hone that concentration until it's steady and pure, dhyana, and that meditative state leads you into deepest ecstasy and into samadhi, where there is the unified awareness only of the Purusha. All else has fallen away. But these are steps that take long to achieve. So it's a journey. Yoga is not instantaneous, and Patanjali, probably pulling together floating streams of teachings from various sorts, himself is a master of, or is interested in, Kriya Yoga, which he describes as being tapas, swadhyaya, and Ishvara Prandidhani. So, tapas is that ancient ideal of building heat within through your concentration. And of course, there is the power of concentration. If you don't have it, if you effortfully apply yourself, what is a weakness at first will become a strength. And then, of course, devoting yourself to the ideal. Now, this has been misinterpreted in later centuries as being devotionally fixed to the Ishvara who is going to save you. No, it is looking at what that Ishvara is like in devoting yourself until you attain that ideal. You become like that Ishvara, that silent Purusha who's not involved with anything, paying no attention to any of the activities of nature. Once you're in this nature, though, Patanjali recognizes that it's going to take a while. Even the sages still have the will to live, even though they shouldn't. They should be willing to quit the body. Where have we heard this before? Jainism, Buddhism. Later we'll hear it in Shankara's Vedanta. So you start with this. You start with the idea that I will withhold myself from actions which are harmful. I'm not going to grasp at things. I'm not going to hurt things. And then I'm going to become pure, and I'm going to study myself. I'm going to get ready. And how I deal with the world and how I deal with myself, I'm going to get myself straightened out. I'm going to establish strong virtues. That's what the yamas and the niyamas are meant to do. And then you learn how to sit. Now, interestingly, when Patanjali says sit, he means sit. Take an asana, sit. It's not do 84 asanas or 7,000 asanas. It's sit. Compose yourself and find a posture which is comfortable for you, would be our recommendation. And then you begin to breathe steadily, gently, with a body that's made still and a breath that's made rhythmic. You're achieving the same things. With the body being motionless, all the restless activity that we normally undertake, you know, we're scratching our cheek or we're shuffling this way and that way. You know, we've got to be doing something. We can't sit still. You cause the body to become silent and still as a statue. And then all those restless energies that are always moving around suddenly become composed. And instead of frittering away your energy, you have amassed this physical energy. When you learn to breathe rhythmically up and down at the same pace, then your emotions fall into line. Then when you start to look at the way your mind works and carry your senses or your attention away from the call of the senses, it becomes composed too. This life force, calms the mind and keeps calm the body. So all have become, in a sense, unified. They have become harmonized. And we haven't even started meditating yet. We've simply settled down the vehicle. And then we start to push inside. We do a concentration, dharana. And that dharana draws that consciousness, which has been restrained from its objects, into itself, focuses upon it, and at first, as anybody will tell you that's tried, that concentration wavers. It goes this way, it goes that way. It has a few good seconds, it breaks loose, it goes cantering off again. That's the way it is at first. But you either fix your vision on an image, or I think the Yoga Sutras prefer that you take a mantra. For instance, Ishvara is associated with the syllable Om. So you take that Om and you move into it. As you move into it, there is this turbulence. There is everything calling you from outside, but you forgot to do this first. You forgot to do that. I itch. I'm uncomfortable. My leg hurts. It's too warm. You ignore it all. You just push ahead straight into that object that you're looking at. As you become closer to that object, as your concentration improves, the climate around you suddenly shifts and begins to support that inner movement. So subject and object draw closer together in this welcoming environment. And then there is an illumination. A bija, a seed of light, begins to shine. And you have to ride the waves of consciousness to stay focused on that seed of light. That light may take that object of your meditation and make it gigantic, or it may make it minuscule and you can't find it anymore, and you're effortfully looking for it. But instead of doing that, you learn to relax and simply ride the wave of concentration, and suddenly you're in a steady orbit around that, and the state has become one of dhyana, of true meditation. Self and object are harmonized, and then that light is all that exists. The subject has disappeared. There is only that. And then the object disappears and there is only the ground of being, then that is called samadhi. And one has moved from the idea of an inner state which is supported by looking at gross or external objects, the sound of the mantra, the reality of the internal Om, the disappearance of that. Only Om exists, I don't exist anymore. Then Om is gone, I am gone. Only that ground of being is there. And that brings about what in the fourth chapter is described as the rain cloud samadhi, where there is a showering of consciousness from above. But again, that's a description that's not present in the first three chapters. Simply is described what that release is like in the various stages of ascent until you get there. So it is almost a handbook of what the various stages of ascent look like, so that when you get there, you know it. You can read back and say, oh, this is what I've experienced. There's a little danger in that, too, that you can begin to tell yourself stories. Well, I've had this and I've had that, and really it's just a lot of sing-song. You know, you haven't really done that, but you think you have. So the necessity of sticking to the path and having adequate instruction is as necessary in the practice of the Yoga Sutras as it is elsewhere. Later, the Yoga Sutras would be identified with what came to be called Raja Yoga. Long story there. I don't think we'll get into that tonight. It's unnecessary. Let us recognize, though, that the Yoga Sutras have a vast history. We have a few sources of different approaches recording different words. When Al-Biruni was forced to come to India and work in the court of his Islamic conqueror, he went out and he surveyed all that was going on religiously, spiritually in India. And he came upon a teaching which was like this. And instead of being 195 aphorisms like this, it was in the form of a dialogue. And you can read it. You can go find Al-Biruni's India and read that today in translation. Very similar, but not the same. There are other versions also. There's an old Javanese version, which is different in very interesting respects from what we have here. I've already mentioned that many of the manuscripts that we have extant to us are different in some respects, each from the other. Very rarely do we have the entire 195 sutras all by themselves standing apart. Usually they're in the gloss of Vyasa, later of Bhoja, who was a king who gave great battle to Mahmud of Ghazni and really was a benevolent emperor who was apparently a sage himself. Vyasa is the first, probably the founding commentator who established the Yoga Sutra. And then we have after that Vachaspati Mishra, who wrote perhaps the most insightful of the commentaries on the Yoga Sutras. And then Vijnana Bhikshu, who had a Vedantic axe to grind, but still made a lot of interesting comments upon it. not to dwell too much on the history, when we get to the late 19th and early 20th century, we see after a lapse of some 400 years in which the Yoga Sutras just disappear from the scene, because since they're not theistic, and there's a great rise of theism and bhakti religions, that they're just not needed anymore. So the kings don't pay for them to be copied, and they just sort of fade into oblivion. It's picked up by an English translator, Colebrooke, and later by Vivekananda, and that begins a sort of renaissance for the Yoga Sutras, and now they're popular again. In fact, there are probably millions more people reading the Yoga Sutras now than there ever were in the past, but they don't understand the context. The Yoga Sutras today are taught as if they are part and parcel, cheek and jowl, with the practice of Hatha Yoga, and nothing could be farther from the truth. When we get to Hatha Yoga, we'll spend a little more time talking about that. And when we get to the Tantra, we'll spend a little more time talking about Hatha Yoga. So let's keep these things separate. I can't throw everything into a milkshake blender and pour it back out after having been blended and say, this is what the entire Indian tradition looks like. We can't impose on earlier strata what becomes a common perspective in the 19th and 20th century. If it didn't exist then, it didn't exist, and that's just the way it is. So the idea that the Yoga Sutras are telling us to realize our oneness with the Supreme God is just not so. To equate the Yoga Sutras with the bhakti religions, just not so. To equate the Yoga Sutras with the practice of Hatha Yoga, the strengthening and the enlivening of the physical tissues, not so. Clearly, the Yoga Sutras are aiming at release from the body, not the perfection of the body. I think I'll pause and see if you have any questions. This has been a rapid race through the Yoga Sutras, which I think will delight some of my friends.